Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here in episode 51, I'm going to make a bold prediction early in the year. I am casting my vote for the coronavirus pandemic to be the public health story of 2020. I hope that I'm wrong. My suspicions, though, are that if I'm wrong, it'll be less because the coronavirus peters out and probably because we have something worse that happens. Sorry to be negative, but there are a lot of negative trends. But I'm making this prediction just because it's good to forecast things and then you can say if you're right or wrong later on. You know, we'll see how it affects my credibility along the line here. But also, just to underscore for you, your community, and our planet, how important this pandemic is going to be coming to a neighborhood near you soon. Okay, I want to do two stories that I think really nail this. One that gets to the underlying reasons why I think this community transmission is going to take off and be sustained in the United States. And another article that talks more about preparation for this emerging epidemic in the U.S. Okay, let's start from the L.A. Times. If coronavirus sweeps America, blame our brutal work and healthcare culture. Nancy Messonnier, director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, outlined the steps that ordinary Americans might take to stem the spread of COVID-19, the viral disease causing panic and disruption around the globe. Households might have to keep patients, along with family members they may have infected, at home. Schools might have to close. Businesses might have to allow workers who can perform their jobs without coming to the workplace to telecommute. Messonnier, whose agency is part of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, acknowledged that these measures might involve, quote, unwanted consequences and further disruptions, including missed work and loss of income. No kidding. Messonnier outlined the realities that all but guarantee that COVID-19 will spread within the U.S. A huge proportion of American workers simply don't have the economic power to stay home, whether to care for family members or even to give themselves a chance to recover from a viral infection in solitude, or the legal right to take off from work without losing their jobs or pay. Millions of Americans, moreover, don't have access to health care without shouldering significant bills. That will keep many people out of doctor's offices or even emergency rooms where they might be screened for the novel coronavirus. Put simply, the consequences of America's working culture and its fragmented, overpriced health care system may hit home in a major way. About a quarter of all American workers have no right to sick leave, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In service industries, where employees must report to their places of employment to work and are most likely to come in contact with the public, more than half have no sick leave. About two-thirds of all workers have access to health benefits at work, but that's overstating things, because the cost of premiums can be more than they can afford. Only about half of eligible workers actually sign up for coverage. And when they do, many still face daunting deductibles or copays that keep them from seeking care. Those circumstances mean that workers who should stay home are likely to remain on the job at the expense of their own health and others' health. If one of us gets sick, we have no choice but to keep driving, says Alvaro Balianes, 33, who has been driving full-time for the ride-hailing services Uber and Lyft for the last 6 years. Balianes, who says he earned about $35,000 last year, but only about $10,000 after expenses, says that on a Facebook group of thousands of drivers he belongs to, concerned about the effects of COVID-19 outbreak has become topic A. We don't have medical or savings because we're barely making enough to pay our rent or bills. This could hugely intensify the public health crisis caused by COVID-19. The closest analogous case occurred in 2009 when the H1N1 flu virus struck the U.S. An estimated 26 million residents were infected by the virus from September through November that year, the peak months of the pandemic, but an estimated 8 million continued to go to work. By the following February, public health authorities reckoned that those carriers infected some 7 million co-workers. The problem was especially acute in the private sector, where paid sick leave was relatively rare. Presenteeism, attending work while ill, among private sector employees without paid sick days, may have extended the duration of the outbreak, a study by Pennsylvania State University concluded. The problem extended to school children. Those whose parents had access to sick leave stayed home, but those whose parents did not stayed in school, raising the risk of infecting their fellow pupils. The U.S. hasn't seemed to have learned the lesson of 2009. Since millions of private sector workers still get no sick leave, today about 91% of state and local government workers are eligible for paid sick leave, but only 73% of the privately employed. In the private sector, moreover, paid sick leave is a privilege reserved largely to professionals, managers, and the better paid. It's available to only about 58% of service workers, less than half of those in the lowest 25% of income range, and only 3 in 10 of those in the lowest 10% of wage earners. Even where sick leave is available in the U.S., typically by state or local ordinance, it's often unpaid. In Britain, however, workers are entitled to sick pay of at least $120 a week for up to 7 months at their employer's expense. In France, the government and employers together cover 90% of a worker's pay for up to 30 days of sick leave, 67% after that. In China, the epicenter of the developing outbreak, workers are guaranteed 60 to 100% of their salary for up to 6 months, depending on their seniority, and 40 to 60% for up to 6 months after that. Those liberal standards may have eased the pain for workers when authorities imposed stringent quarantines in Wuhan province, where the virus is thought to have originated. In the U.S., no federal law requires paid sick leave. California and 9 other states, and Washington, D.C., and some other cities have enacted mandates, but they're typically much less generous than the standards overseas. California's law, which went into effect in 2015, gives workers at least 1 hour of sick leave for every 30 hours worked and allows employers to cap the leave at 3 days per year. Let me say that again, 3 days per year, though unused time can be carried over to the following year. The lack of paid time off for workers reflects the dominance of management culture over labor interests in the U.S. over the last century. Business fought back aggressively against governments urging for shorter hours and better pay during the New Deal, for example, and that was in a period when labor rights were on the rise. At the heart of the Great Depression in 1934, Alfred P. Sloan, then chairman of General Motors, returned from 3 weeks of vacation in France to condemn the government's position, saying, "Of course I believe in more leisure for workers," he said from the wharf, "but we should get it by reduced costs and increased efficiency, not by government edict. We should earn our leisure." The lack of paid sick leave is only one of the conditions that will hamper efforts to control COVID-19. The other is a healthcare system that either renders millions of residents ineligible for care or prices it so high that even those offered health plans can't afford to sign up or use them. A survey conducted jointly in 2019 by The Times and Kaiser Family Health Foundation found that 4 in 10 Americans with employer-sponsored health coverage still had difficulty affording the health plan or treatment. 1 in 4 couldn't afford medical bills before meeting their deductible, and 14% couldn't afford copays or prescriptions. Of those facing financial obstacles, half had placed their charges on credit cards or used up all or most of their savings to pay medical expenses. Two-thirds had cut spending on food or clothing to pay the bills. The reason is no secret. The cost of employer health coverage has been rising. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, average deductibles for employer-sponsored single coverage rose from $1,655 in 2019 from $584 in 2006. That's just single coverage. That makes health coverage unattainable for low-income workers. That's the case for Amparo Ramirez, 48, who works in the cold food facility of the airline catering service, Sky Chefs at LAX, where she earns the minimum wage of $15.25 an hour, preparing meals for airline passengers. Ramirez says she can't afford premiums for the company's health plan to cover herself and her two daughters. Even my coworkers who have the coverage say they have to use half their paychecks to get care, she told me. Instead, she sometimes drives to Tijuana to obtain low-cost treatment or medicines. Only 33% of Sky Chef's workers at LAX carry health insurance for themselves, and only 10% cover dependents, according to Unite Here Local 11, which represents 900 workers at the company. The union says that nearly two-thirds of the respondents to a survey of 124 of its LAX members reported having gone to work sick. Ramirez says she's been working, although she has been suffering from a form of bronchitis for 3 months. Her employer would grant her up to 2 days of sick leave, but after that she would need to produce a doctor's note, something she can't get because she can't afford to see a doctor. Obstacles like these are bound to keep people from seeking treatment, even if they have suspect they've contracted COVID-19. Government officials haven't appeared to get the message that the American system itself may be a threat to public health if COVID-19 takes root within our borders. And once it does, the Trump administration doesn't appear to accept its responsibility to ensure that treatment is widely available. The administration has spent 3 years narrowing Americans' opportunities for affordable health care and trying to shrink public health programs such as Medicaid, which could become a bulwark against the virus spread if allowed to serve low-income patients without political interference. Asked at a congressional hearing about to guarantee that once a vaccine against the virus is developed, it would be available to all, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, a former pharmaceutical executive, refused. What did he say? We would want to ensure that we work to make it affordable, but we can't control the price because we need the private sector to invest. Price controls won't get us there. In other words, the administration, for all its rhetoric about protecting Americans from the viral epidemic, will take a hands-off approach once it comes to pass. Well, now that COVID-19 seems to be spreading in the community and is destined to be widely an epidemic in the U.S., it'll be interesting to see what the Trump administration does. I think their more fascist tendencies will try, more restrictions. But the thing is, there is a reverse of polarity between international and domestic politics. Trump may actually gain politically by restricting international travel, particularly of countries he doesn't particularly like anyways. Like talk about closing the southern border when there's no reported cases in Mexico, for instance. Nothing that's science-based, but just driven by politics. But of course, when it comes in the U.S., once you start restricting Americans' travel or wanting to quarantine or socially isolate, which are indeed legitimate public health interventions, we'll see if a scientific approach, he listens to his science advisors, or he follows more political approaches. Okay, well, that remains to be seen as this rolls out. But let's move to the next article, and this is more about the things that you can do you and your community, you and your neighbors can do to stem this epidemic. This is from Scientific American. Preparing for coronavirus to strike the U.S. As the human coronavirus spreads around the world, individuals and families should prepare. But are we? The Centers for Disease Control has already said that it expects community transition in the United States and asks families to be ready for the possibility of, quote, significant disruption to our lives. But ready? But how? It seems to me that some people may be holding back from preparing because of their understandable dislike of associating such preparation with doomsday or prepper subcultures. Another possibility is that people may have learned that for many people the disease is mild, which is certainly true, so they don't think it's a big risk to them. Also, many doomsday scenarios advise extensive preparation for increasingly outlandish scenarios, and this may seem daunting and pointless, and it is. Others may not feel like contributing to a panic or appearing to be selfish. Forget all that. Preparing for the almost inevitable global spread of this virus, now dubbed COVID-19, is one of the most pro-social, altruistic things you can do in response to potential disruptions of this kind. We should prepare, not because we feel personally at risk, but so that we can help lessen the risk for everyone. We should prepare not because we are facing a doomsday scenario out of control, but because we can alter every aspect of this risk we face as a society. That's right. You should prepare yourself because your neighbors need you to prepare, especially your elderly neighbors, your neighbors who work in hospitals, your neighbors with chronic illnesses, and your neighbors who may not have the means or the time to prepare because of lack of resources or time. Prepper and survivalist subcultures are often associated with doomsday scenarios and extreme steps. People stocking and hoarding supplies, building bunkers and preparing to go off the grid so that they may survive some untold catastrophe, brandishing weapons to guard their compound while their less prepared neighbors perish. All this appears both extreme and selfish, and to be honest, a little nutty. In contrast, the real crisis scenarios we're likely to encounter require cooperation and, crucially, flattening the curve of the crisis exactly so the more vulnerable can fare better, so that our infrastructure will be less stressed at any one time. What does flattening the curve mean for the current COVID-19 threat facing us? The emerging pandemic of this human coronavirus? Epidemiologists often talk about two important numbers. R-naught, or how infectious a disease might be, expresses the number of people that are infected by each person who's been infected, and for the case fatality ratio, the number of people who die as a result of being infected. For example, the R-naught of 2 means each infected person infects 2 people on average, while a number less than 1 means the disease is likely dying out in the population. Some diseases are deadlier than others. The average case of fatality for Ebola has been around 50%, for example, while the common cold is rarely deadly for otherwise healthy individuals. So here's the thing. Such epidemiological numbers are not fixed or immutable. They are not constants that exist independent of our actions. Where they land depends on the characteristics of the pathogen, but also our response. By preparing now, we can alter both of these key numbers and save many lives. The infectiousness of a virus, for example, depends on how much we encounter one another, how well we quarantine individuals who are ill, how often we wash our hands, whether those treating the ill have proper protective equipment, how healthy we are to begin with, and such factors are all under our control. After active measures were implemented, the R-naught for the 2003 SARS epidemic, for example, went from around 3, meaning each person infected 3 others, to 0.04. It was our response to SARS in 2003 that made sure the disease died out from Earth, with less than 1,000 victims globally. Similarly, how many people die of seasonal flu, or COVID-19, depends on the kind of health care they receive. In China, death rates are much higher in the overwhelmed Hubei province than the rest of the country exactly because of the quality of care. Hospitals only have so many beds, especially in their intensive care units, and those who have severe cases of COVID-19 often need mechanical ventilation and other intensive care procedures. When they are out of beds, people end up languishing at home and suffering and dying in much larger numbers. All this means that if we can slow the transmission of the disease, flatten its curve, there will be many more lives saved, even if the same number of people eventually get sick, because everyone won't show up at the hospital all at once. Plus, if we can flatten that curve, there's more time to develop a vaccine or find antivirals that help. There are now COVID-19 cases around the world and epidemiological data from tens of thousands of cases. Here's what we know. No doubt to the relief of parents everywhere, this disease is mild to non-existent in children. There are almost no pediatric deaths, and very few kids even seem to fall sick, though children may still have clinically barely detectable cases, thus infecting others. On the other hand, for the elderly or for people who have other diseases or comorbidities, it's very serious, with death rates reaching up to 15%. It's also a great threat to health workers who handle people with the virus every day, with thousands of cases already. Overall, it appears to have a case fatality rate around 2%, which is certainly very serious. Seasonal flu, a serious threat in and of itself, has a case fatality rate around 0.1% in the United States. So this coronavirus is about 20 times as deadly, though again, this number may get much better or worse depending on the kind of care we can provide. There are also enough examples of mild or barely symptomatic COVID-19 cases and a long enough incubation period that this disease will almost certainly not be contained. We can't expect to reliably detect everyone who's ill and infectious as we could with the SARS-2003 epidemic, where the victims always exhibited high fever and thus were easy to identify and isolate. All this means that the only path for flattening the curve for COVID-19 is community-wide isolation. The more people stay home, the fewer people will catch the disease. The fewer people who catch the disease, the better hospitals can help those who do. Crowding at hospitals doesn't just threaten those with COVID-19. If emergency rooms are overwhelmed, more flu patients too will die because of lack of treatment, for example. And we're in flu season, editorial note there. Community-wide isolation also means that people will depend on deliveries for essentials. In Ground Zero of Hubei Province, for example, that's what's happening. But there are only so many delivery workers, and while deliveries are better than people going shopping, it's still a risk to everyone involved. So if fewer people need deliveries, then fewer people will get sick, and more people who need help, such as the elderly, can still get deliveries as the services will be less overwhelmed. Here's what all this means in practice. Get a flu shot if you haven't already, and stock up supplies at home so that you can stay home for 2 to 3 weeks, going out as little as possible. The flu shot helps decrease the odds of having to go to the hospital for the flu, or worse yet, get both flu and COVID-19. Comorbidities drastically worsen outcomes. Staying home without needing deliveries means that not only are you less likely to get sick, thus freeing up hospitals for more vulnerable populations, it means that you are less likely to infect others. While you may be having a mild case, you can still infect an elderly person or someone with cancer or another significant illness, and you allow delivery personnel to help out others. If you are in a position of authority, which means figuring out how to help people stay at home by preparing for and allowing for remote work or allowing for future work to be made up for missed days and other similar plans, households and others who employ part-time work help can do this too. Continue paying the cleaners. It can be reconciled later. Without pay, people will not be able to prepare or stay home. If you live in a regular household, here's a handy guide on what you need. Potable water. That's a general just-in-case item for all emergencies. Shelf-stable food that doesn't need refrigeration. Again, just in case. Your prescription medication and a few basic medical supplies. First aid, your usual over-the-counter meds. Depending on the composition of your household, things to keep you busy, books, board games, toys. Many are trying to stock up on masks, and many places have already run out, giving us a taste of what it means not to flatten the curve. If everyone gets masks all at once, there is just no way to keep up. However, don't worry if you cannot find masks. Those are most important for healthcare workers. Masks are useful for protecting others from your germs and also for making it harder or reminding you not to touch your face. For non-healthcare people, washing your hands often, using alcohol-based hand sanitizer liberally, and learning not to touch your face are the most important clinically proven interventions there are. And teaching this to kids is priceless, as they may be healthy, but they are quite the germ vectors. Clinical studies show amazing results by just washing hands regularly and well, that is at least 20 seconds. Of course, if you yourself have any illness, cold or flu, don't sneeze or cough on people. For food, you can buy just 2 or 3 weeks worth of shelf-stable food that you would eat anyway and be done. This could include canned food like beans and vegetables, pasta, rice, cereals or oats, oils and fats, nuts and dried fruits. It's really not that hard because we're talking about 2 to 3 weeks, so whatever you get is fine. It doesn't have to be expensive or super healthy or specialized ready-to-eat meals in camel boxes guaranteed to survive the meteor strike. Rice, beans, salsa, ramen, some sort of cooking oil, oatmeal, nuts and dried or canned foods and vegetables enough for 2 weeks can be had at relatively little cost and take up fairly little space. Why not rely on refrigerated food? Sure, keep your fridge full, but this isn't the backup you need for 2 weeks. I personally don't think the lights or water are going out. They haven't in China, even in places like Hubei that are under much more stress, and they didn't even during the catastrophic Spanish flu pandemic at the end of World War I. However, it's generally good advice to rely on shelf-stable food and have some potable water in the house just in case there's some sort of temporary hiccup. A portable power bank for your phone that is kept charged is similarly generously useful anyway. If you need prescription or other medications, it's a good idea to stock up if possible, if for no other reason than to avoid pharmacies, both to reduce their burden and also to not be in the same line as people who may be ill. That's mostly it for a household, along with whatever will help keep your household entertained and busy. Okay, well, prepare, folks, because in the weeks or months ahead, we will have to be riding out this thing. This will be a big test, I think, about our social fabric and how we respond. Let's have it not based on fear, but based on a profound neighborliness that is the highest values and ideals of American culture. Okay, well, let's finish up with a quick public health news and research roundup where I gather up all the other wonderful things in the world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention, listeners. As per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
Okay, let's start off with a little bit of good news from Reuters. Bayer chairman quits as Roundup settlements talks progress. Bayer chairman Werner Wenning, one of the architects of the $63 billion takeover deal that has left the German crop protection company fighting costly lawsuits, will step down in April. Bayer shares have plunged about a quarter in value since August 2018, when the company lost the first U.S. lawsuit claiming weed killer Roundup, acquired via the takeover of Monsanto, causes cancer. In October 2019, the number of plaintiffs more than doubled to 42,700 within just 3 months, and analysts have predicted it may cost the company up to $12 billion to lay the claims to rest. Well, Mr. CEO, good riddance, and I, for one, welcome new mismanagement. Okay, let's hit a couple healthcare stories. This is from the Washington Post. Here's that Medicare for All study Bernie Sanders keeps bringing up. A new analysis published in the journal Lancet adds some empirical heft to an argument many progressives have been making for years. A national single-payer healthcare system would save tens of thousands of lives each year and hundreds of billions of dollars. All told, the study concludes, a single-payer system akin to Sanders' plan would slash the nation's healthcare expenditures by 13%, or more than $450 billion each year. Not only that, ensuring healthcare access for all Americans would save more than 68,000 lives each year. And it's all up. Add it all up, and here's what you get. A new system that would cost about $3 trillion a year instead of $3.5 trillion that is now being spent. Galvani and her colleagues estimate that to fully fund Medicare for All, the federal government would have to bring in an additional $773 billion a year relative to current revenue levels. They estimate this could be paid for in part by a 10% payroll tax that would bring in $436 billion annually. Given that current employers' contributions to healthcare work out to about 12% of payrolls, this would still be about a $100 billion less than what employers currently pay. The remaining funding could be paid via a 5% tax on household income, yielding $375 billion a year. Again, with the elimination of employees' contributions to existing health insurance premiums, the average household could expect to save well over $2,000 a year and have no copays or deductibles to worry about. Lack of universal healthcare system means that regular medical care is unaffordable for many Americans. Fully one quarter of us have to put off needed care because of cost. More than 8 million Americans have started a crowdfunding campaign to pay for Medicare, with approximately 1 in 5 Americans contributing to somebody else's medical crowdfunding campaign. 90% of those campaigns will fail to raise the necessary funds. By addressing these and other problems, Galvani and her colleagues estimate that regardless of cost, Medicare for All would save about 69,000 lives each year. They end their paper by calling on the medical community to answer the moral imperative to provide healthcare as a human right, not dependent on employment or affluence. I did the calculations on the 69,000 lives a year, and that's just actually from people that are uninsured. So I'm not sure how they did actually calculate the numbers of years of potential life lost. And that turned out to actually be 25 years of potential life loss for every death when they're talking about that 69,000. Now, again, that might be more than that 69,000 because the 69,000 is just people who don't have any health insurance and doesn't fully account for kind of the underinsurance that we have in our system. But either way, it's a profound, that's a profound number and a lot larger than the gain that we made by moving to Obamacare from pre-Obamacare. So we've come a long way and we have a lot farther to go, but Medicare for All can take us there. Okay, related to that, from the Hill, Obamacare favorability hits highest level. The Affordable Care Act's favorability hit a record high in a new poll highlighting the shifting political tones around the law. A Kaiser Family Foundation poll finds that 55% of the public views the health law favorably, the highest level since they began polling the question about 10 years ago. Just 37% said they view it unfavorably. Obamacare has long viewed more unfavorably than favorably, especially during the troubled rollout of the healthcare.gov website in late 2013. But that changed with President Trump's election in 2016, when favorability began rising amid the Republican push to repeal the law in 2017. The healthcare law has now become a political asset for Democrats, who highlighted Republican repeal attempts to help win back the House in 2018. The law's protections for people with pre-existing conditions have been particularly popular. With Trump still backing a lawsuit to overturn the law, Democrats are seeking to repeat that strategy in 2020. Republican voters have likewise become less enthusiastic about repealing the law. In 2016, 29% of Republican voters listed Obamacare repeal as their top healthcare issue. Now it's down to just 3%. Okay, I'd like to end the show on with a positive story. And particularly since we're in this coronavirus epidemic, it's going to require us to be neighborly and altruistic and cooperative rather than competitive, xenophobic, etc., etc. So this is a story from NPR. Survival of the Friendliest. How our close friendships help us thrive. A growing field of science shows that friendship is vital to our health. Lydia Denworth wants you to make more time for your friends. We don't fully appreciate our friendships, says the science writer and author of the new book, Friendship, The Evolution, Biology, and Extraordinary Power of Life's Fundamental Bond. If we did, we'd take cultivating those intimate bonds as seriously as working out or eating well. Because, she writes, a new field of science is revealing that social connections play a vital role in our health. On average, people have only 4 very close relationships, Denworth finds, and very few people can sustain more than 6. But the effect of these few core relationships extends beyond our social lives, influencing our health on the cellular level, from our immune system to our cardiovascular system. Denworth spoke with NPR about the science of friendships and its underestimated value to kids and adults and even for other species like sheep and fish. Although she's frequently asked about human-animal relationships, Denworth sticks to bonds within one species in this book. What is the most misunderstood about friendships? Very few people understand what your social relationships can actually change. Very few people understand that your social relationships can actually change your health. They can change your cardiovascular system, your immune system, how you sleep, your cognitive health. How could this thing that exists entirely outside the body affect whether you're likely to catch a virus? And yet that's exactly what we now know that social connection does. We thought of loneliness as this difficult emotion, but just an emotion. And we think of friends as this lovely thing, but it is actually a matter of life and death. There's this evolutionary drive to connect. People think all the time about competition and survival of the fittest, but really it's survival of the friendliest. Is friendship just something humans do, or do we see it in other species? People think all the time about competition and survival of the fittest, but really it is survival of the friendliest. What has been surprising to evolutionary biologists is just how much friendship exists across species. They have found something that looks like friendship in dolphins and elephants and horses and zebras and hyenas and all kinds of species. Even fish, their brains respond to familiar fish versus strange fish in ways that look a lot like what goes on in our brains. Understanding what tells you there's this much larger story than just human culture. And That's what people thought friendship was, a product of human culture and language, but now we understand that it is universal. Are bonds and friends different from bonds with romantic or sexual partners, or bonds with family? I don't actually think that it's all that unique. We generally think of friends as people we don't have sex with and to whom we're not related. But the truth is that in this new science, and in fact the way we live our lives, those lines are blurred. I think of friendship now as a template for all of your relationships. Because if you think about the sort of basic definition of friendship, it makes you feel good, it's positive, a long-lasting, stable relationship, and it has some cooperation and reciprocity to it. That's what you want to be striving for in your closest relationships. And that can be with your spouse or your sibling or a relative, but not always. What matters is the quality of the bond, not its origin. Does gender play a role in friendships? The standard line is that women do friendship face-to-face and men do it side-by-side, meaning women spend their time talking and men doing things together. And there's truth to that, but when you ask men how much they value friendship, their answers are the same for the most part. The similarities are greater than the differences between men and women. One of your chapters focuses on the special aspect of middle school. How did researching that affect your thinking as a parent? The middle school thing, it's such a crucible, and it really is true. Middle school is about lunch. Most parents thinking about their kids going to middle school, they do know that socially can be a very difficult time, but they don't necessarily think about how that plays out in the course of a day. Realizing that crystallized to me this idea that friendship really, really matters in kids' lives, and we are falling down on the job as parents and teachers if we aren't fully understanding that. Things that I might have said no to before, I'm more likely to say yes to now if it means that my kids are going to be with their good friends. Is social media helping or hurting our relationships? Friendship is alive and well in the age of social media. In terms of relationships and connectivity and networks, it's a positive. The place where it is hard on relationships is when you're face-to-face, and instead of looking at your friends, you're looking at your phone. Looking at a person face-to-face, in person, your brain responds differently, even if you look at that same person on a screen, and certainly if you're online and not looking at their face. There's all this talk about the word friend being devalued by things like Facebook using the term, but I don't think that's true. We know who our really good friends are, whether we're online with them or not. Do you see friendship taken for granted in the world around you? I do. Friendship is so familiar that we think we know all about it, but we don't fully appreciate it. We think it's pleasurable and fun, but friends are often the first thing to go when we're busy. Or you fall in love and ditch your friends. I was guilty myself of passing a friend on the street corner here in Brooklyn and saying, let's definitely get together, and then not. We are so achievement-driven in so much of what we do, I think it's healthy to be reminded that time with other people really matters. How did writing this book make you think differently about your own friendships? It made me prioritize them more. The message is not that I want people to think of friendship as another chore. I am hoping that people feel this is giving them permission to make friends a priority, to spend time with their friends and to know that when they do, they're doing something good for their own health and for their friends' health, and I've taken that to heart. Well, folks, my friends, thank you for joining the show today. If you'd like to review this show or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.